part of the lecture talking about graph problems, and actually we'll be talking about only a very small fraction of the different graph problems people are interested in solving with respect to graphs, the number of such problems easily exceeding a few thousand. All right, so first part of the lecture, look at a few popular problems studied on graphs. I'll just introduce the problems, we'll look at their solutions in some other lecture. And then in the second part of the lecture, we shall take a look at different ways to represent graphs. Okay. All right, so let's look at some sample graph problems. Probably the most popular or commonly studied class of problems would fall into problems called path problems. Another popular class called connectedness problems, problems related to whether or not a graph is connected, a term I will define more precisely later. And then spanning tree problems. So these are the three classes of problems I want to talk about in the first part of today's lecture. Start with pathfinding problems. So here you're given a graph. In this particular example, we have an undirected graph, and it has 11 vertices. The numbers within the vertices are the vertex numbers, so 1 through 11. The numbers outside on the edges are the edge weights, and the edge weights may be, for example, driving distances. If your vertices represent cities, then the edges could be labeled with the time it takes to drive from city 1 to city 2. Or the weights could be the distance, so maybe from city 1 to city 2, it's 4 miles, say. Okay. All right, so we have a graph where the edges have weights on them, and we're interested in finding a path between two vertices, for example, a path from vertex 1 to vertex 2. Okay. So a path is simply a sequence of edges and vertices. So it's an alternating sequence of vertices and edges. We start at the source vertex for our path, vertex 1. We follow an edge that is incident on vertex 1, and we reach vertex 2. Then from vertex 2, we follow another edge and reach vertex 5. We follow another edge and get to vertex 9. And from here, my path gets me to vertex 8. And that gives me a path then from vertex 1 to vertex 8. The length of this path is obtained by summing up the weights on the edges. Okay. Now, in some cases of pathfinding, the edges may not have weights on them. In those cases, too, we would be able to define a quantity called the length of a path, and that would simply be the number of edges on the path. Okay. So if I'd given you a graph that didn't have edge weights, and I asked you the length of this path, you'd say, well, that's 1, 2, 3, and 4, so you'd have a path of length 4. But when the weights are there, path length is generally interpreted as being the sum of the weights on the edges on that path. Okay. All right, so at present, in red, what we have here is a path from vertex 1 to vertex 8, and this particular path has a length that is 20. Of course, this is not the only path in this graph between vertices 1 and 8. We can find another one. This one, I guess, started at vertex 1 and went first to vertex 4, and then to vertex 6, vertex 7, and then to 5, 9, and 8. Okay. All right, so this particular path, if you add up the weights on the edges on this particular path has a length that is 28. All right, so the thing to note is that different paths between the same vertices have or may have different length. And when people are looking at path problems, in one version of a path problem, you could be given two vertices like 1 and 8, asked to find a path from 1 to 8 that has, say, the shortest length. Okay. Now, when you're asked to find a path between two vertices, it's not always the case that a path even exists. Okay. So, for example, if you were to look at this graph here, and you were asked to find a path from, let's say, vertex 2 to vertex 9, Well, there is no way to follow edges beginning at vertex 2 and ending up at vertex 9. Okay. So this would be an example of a graph where a path doesn't exist. Okay. So something to keep in mind when you are developing solutions for the pathfinding problem is there may not be a path. Okay. Now, graphs in which there is a path between every pair of vertices are given a special name, namely, we'll call these connected graphs. Okay. So to be more precise, a connected graph is necessarily an undirected graph. Okay. Whatever we said so far about paths could have been said with respect to directed graphs, even though our example was of an undirected graph. But when we talk about connected graphs, we are necessarily talking about a graph that is not directed. There are no directed edges. It is an undirected graph. Okay. In addition to being an undirected graph, it must be the case that between every pair of vertices in the graph, there is a path. Okay. So the example we just saw, this one here, this would be an example of a graph that is not connected. Okay. There is no path from vertex 3 to 9 or 2 to 9 or 5 to 8 and so on. Okay. Of course, it's not too difficult to connect this graph. Okay. To connect this graph, we need to simply take any one of the vertices on this side and draw an edge between any one of those vertices and one of the vertices on this side here. Okay. So that would give us a graph that is connected. All right, and this is what I've done here. I've added an edge between vertex 5 and 9, and that makes the whole graph connected. Okay. All right, so a problem that people are interested in asking with respect to undirected graphs is this graph connected or not? Okay. Now, another question people like to ask with respect to undirected graphs is to identify something called the connected components of the graph. Okay. By a connected component, I mean a maximal connected subgraph. So what that means is that you take a subgraph of the original graph. A subgraph means you have to take some of the vertices and some of the edges. You can't introduce new vertices and new edges. There got to be existing vertices and edges from the original graph that was given to you. That subgraph has to be connected, so there has to be a path between every pair of vertices in the subgraph. In addition, it should not be possible for you to create a larger subgraph, which is also connected. So you shouldn't be able to expand this subgraph into a bigger one that is also connected. Okay. That's certainly true for everything enclosed in red out here. If we try to go to a bigger subgraph by adding vertices and edges from the original graph, we would necessarily end up with a graph that is not connected. Okay. All right, so this is one connected component. Okay. And in the blue, we have a second connected component. So the graph that was given to us has exactly two connected components. Okay. All right, stating this in words, a connected component is a maximal subgraph that is connected. That means is that first you have to be a subgraph, and you should not be able to add vertices and edges from the original graph and retain the connectedness property. Okay. If your graph was connected to start with, it would have exactly one component. Okay. Right, so for example, this graph here has exactly one component, which is its whole thing, all 11 vertices with all of the edges shown here. Okay. Now, if you were to look at only this subgraph enclosed in the red, that's vertices 1, 2, and 4 together with these two edges, this is a connected subgraph. Okay, you've got three vertices, and between every pair of these three vertices, there is a path in the subgraph. However, it is not a component because I can expand this subgraph into a larger subgraph. For instance, I could add vertex 5 together with this edge, and I would have a larger connected subgraph. And therefore, the smaller connected subgraph is not a component. It can be grown into a larger connected subgraph. Okay. Similarly, this subgraph here, comprised of these four vertices together with these three edges, is not a connected component. Okay. It is a connected subgraph, okay, but it's not a component. Okay. To be a component, you need to be a connected subgraph, but you must also be a maximal connected subgraph, which means that you cannot make this larger by introducing vertices and edges from the given graph and retain the connected property. Here I could add vertex 5 together with the edge 5, 9, making this blue subgraph larger and yet connected. Okay. All right, so if your graph was connected, then you have exactly one component. If it was not connected, you could have more than one component, but components are uniquely defined. Once you have the graph, they have to be the maximal connected subgraphs. All right, so a problem of interest with respect to undirected graphs. First is, tell me if the graph is connected. If it's not connected, I'd like to find its components. One reason you may want to find the components is to decide where you should add edges to make your non-connected graph into a connected graph. So if you go back to our example, if you go back a couple of slides to the example of a graph that was not connected, once we have identified the two components, the red component and the blue one, well then I know that to end up with a connected graph, I need to draw or introduce an edge from any vertex in the red component to any vertex in the blue component. It doesn't do me any good to introduce an edge that connects two vertices in the same component. That's not going to get me closer to making my graph connected. Okay. So one reason to find components is to be able to decide where you should introduce edges so that your graph eventually becomes connected. Okay. All right, so a couple of connectedness problems. Okay. Let's now take a look at a communication network. This will get us to the concept of a spanning tree. Okay. All right, so a communication network consists of vertices and edges, and in this case perhaps each vertex maybe represents a city or point in your communication network, and each link or edge represents a link that is feasible to construct. Okay. So we're trying in this example to build a network. The network has to connect the 11 cities labeled 1 through 11. The edges show links that are feasible to build. Now, we can connect or we can communicate between pairs of vertices by using a path. So, for example, if you want to send a message from vertex 6 to vertex 2, we could do it by first sending it from 6 to 4, and then 4 can relay this message forward to vertex 1, and 1 can then send it to vertex 2. Okay. All right, so an important property of a communication network is that it has to be connected. If it's not connected, there will be pairs of vertices between which you cannot communicate. Okay. Some problems people ask with respect to the network. The network that is given contains the links that are feasible. We aren't necessarily going to build all, it just contains the things that we could possibly build. The first question you might ask as well, is that proposed network connected? Okay, with all the feasible links taken into account. Okay. If the answer is no, you'd like to find the components. Okay. And then you'd like to find the smallest number of, I guess this problem is really not related to the previous one. Okay. So you'd like to find the components. We've indicated why. Once you have the components, you could then think about adding or introducing additional links that perhaps were previously determined to be infeasible, they were too expensive. Maybe you now make them feasible links so that you end up with a connected network. But once you have your connected network, you would then not necessarily want to build every link that is feasible. Okay. So you may want to find the smallest number of feasible links so that the resulting network is connected. Okay. And in order to do that, we make use of a property of cycles in a connected graph. A cycle simply is a path that begins and ends at the same vertex. So for example, 1, 2, 5, 7, 6, 4, 1 would be a cycle. It begins at 1 and ends at 1. Similarly, 6, 5, 7, 6 would be another cycle. Okay. So an interesting property of cycles with respect to connectedness is that if you look at any edge on a cycle, so if you look at the cycle 5, 7, 6, 5, okay, if you look at any edge, in this case the edge 5, 6, if you were to throw this edge out, then a graph that was previously connected would remain connected. If it was not connected, well, throwing an edge out won't suddenly make you connected, you'll still remain unconnected. Okay. So an edge that is on a cycle has the property that the removal of the edge does not affect the connected property of the graph. Okay. So I can take this edge and throw it out, I have a connected graph. Okay. Similarly, if I went over here and looked at the cycle 8, 9, 11, I could take an edge from 8, 9, 11 and throw it out and it would be connected. Again, if I looked at this cycle here and threw out the edge 1, 2, the graph would still be connected. Okay. So an interesting property of connected graphs is that if you throw out an edge on a cycle, doesn't matter which one, you end up with a connected graph. And now you can use this property repeatedly. So perhaps you first identify a cycle, okay, like this one, throw any one of these three edges out. In this case, I'm going to throw out the edge 5, 6. I'm assured that the resulting graph is connected. Okay. Now, since the resulting graph is connected, I can now look for another cycle in the resulting graph. And here I've got this big one, 1, 2, 5, 7, 6, 4, 1. Now my property says I can throw any edge on this cycle out of the graph, and I will still be connected. Okay. It doesn't matter which one you pick. Okay. Okay. So I pick, in this case, the edge 1, 2. And sure enough, we're still connected. Okay. I can apply the property again to this graph, which says, see if there's a cycle. And yes, there is. There is a cycle here. I can now throw any one of these three edges out, and I would still be connected. Okay. So let's say we throw out the edge 8, 11. Okay. Now I can try and apply the property once again. And if I look around, I see there is no cycle. So I can't use this property to reduce the number of edges any further. Okay. Okay. So an interesting property is that if your graph is connected, if it has a cycle, you can throw any edge on the cycle out and the graph will remain connected. Okay. Once you throw out edges from cycles one at a time in this fashion, you're left with a connected graph that has no cycles. Okay. And one can prove that a connected graph that has no cycles, okay, has the minimum possible number of edges, by which I mean if you were to throw out another edge, doesn't matter which one, you would end up with a graph that is not connected. So if you're given 10 vertices, you need a minimum of 9 edges to keep it connected. And when you use 9 edges to connect it, you cannot possibly have a cycle, something that we won't prove here, but we'll simply state. And graph terminology, one uses the term tree to refer to a connected graph that has no cycles. Okay. An n-vertex connected graph with n minus 1 edges must necessarily be a tree. Okay. We're not going to prove that, but this statement is equivalent to saying that you have a connected graph that has no cycles. Okay. So if you have an n-vertex connected graph that has n minus 1 edges, it must necessarily have no cycles, and it would necessarily be a tree. Okay. Now, the use of the term tree in the context of graphs is a little bit different from the use of the term tree that was done several lectures ago when we talked about the data structure tree. When we talked about the data structure tree, in that context, trees do not have in that context, a tree has a specially designated node called the root node. However, in the context of a graph, We don't designate any node as a root. Okay. So if you really want to now refer to the kind of trees we were talking about before, we would need to refer to those as rooted trees. Okay. If you look back at the discussion on trees earlier, you would see that those trees are also connected graphs that have no cycles. The only distinction with tree as defined now and as defined then is that then trees had roots. Here, trees don't have roots. They're simply connected graphs without cycles. Okay. So we'll use the term rooted tree to refer to the trees we were talking about earlier on in the course, connected graphs that have roots. Okay. Right, we'll use the term spanning tree to refer to a subgraph of a graph that includes all of the vertices in the original graph, and the subgraph needs to be a tree. Okay. So a spanning tree is a subgraph that is a tree. Another way to say it is if you started off with an n vertex graph, then a spanning tree would be a subgraph that is a tree and has n vertices. So all the n vertices have to be present. Now, the number of edges in a spanning tree, since the number of vertices equals the number of vertices n in the original graph, the number of edges must necessarily be one less than the number of vertices, n minus 1. Now, in the context of a communication network, if the edges have weights, okay, so perhaps this link here is going to cost us $4 million to construct, and this one is going to cost us $2 million to construct, and that'll set another $2 million there and $7 here. Then when we build our network, we wouldn't be trying to minimize the number of links that are built. What we'd like to do is we'd like to minimize the cost of construction of the network, and that would be obtained by adding up the costs of the different links that we end up building. So if the objective is to construct a minimum cost network that is still connected, okay, so you can still communicate between every pair of vertices or cities, we want to build this at the smallest possible cost, well then we would like to, first we'd like to have a spanning tree. Okay. If it's not a spanning tree, then either you're missing some vertex or it's not a tree. If it's not a tree, you must have a cycle. If you have a cycle, we can throw any edge out and reduce the overall construction cost. Okay. Can we assume that no edge has a negative cost? Okay. Right, so you've got to have a spanning tree, but what we're interested in is not a spanning tree. Well, let me back up a bit. We're not interested in a connected subgraph that has the minimum number of edges, but rather one where the sum of the edge cost is minimum. Okay. So I'm looking for a spanning tree which has the minimum possible cost. Now, let's take a look at some spanning trees for this particular network. Okay. All right, so here's a possible spanning tree. You build these blue edges. Okay. So I've thrown out these two cycle edges and that cycle edge there. Okay. So if you add up the costs of the blue edges, if we were to build these 10 links, the cost would work out to be 51. You just add up the numbers on these 10 blue links, you get 51. Okay, so that's the cost of a possible spanning tree. Here's an alternative spanning tree. And again, it of course has exactly 10 edges. If we add up the cost here, it works up to be 41. Okay, so you get a cheaper spanning tree. Okay, in this case, we can actually show this is a minimum cost spanning tree. You can't do any better than 41. Right, later we'll take a look at how you devise algorithms that would input an undirected graph and would give you a minimum cost spanning tree. And we'll see that these algorithms are fairly fast. Okay. All right, so we've seen so far three kinds of problems people look at commonly for graphs: path problems, connectedness problems, spanning tree problems. Among spanning tree problems, we looked at two so far. We've seen simply finding a spanning tree. That's useful when all the edge costs are the same. The other one is you start with a network where the edges have different costs and you want to find a minimum cost spanning tree. Okay. Now, let's look at a different environment, one where our vertices represent wireless nodes, okay, and maybe these are all operating off of batteries, okay. So we've got wireless nodes out in the field, they're all battery powered, and there's a need for a node to broadcast this message to the remaining nodes in the network. And let's suppose it's vertex 1 has to broadcast, so it needs to broadcast to the remaining 10 nodes, okay, and the edges are labeled with the power needed, okay. So if vertex 1 does a broadcast using 2 units of power, the signal will reach vertex 4. If it uses 4 units of power, the signal will reach both vertex 2 and vertex 4, okay. So if you do a broadcast, you can reach more than one vertex, provided the power level used is enough. Okay. Now, to get to vertex 5, vertex 1 cannot get to vertex, send a message to vertex 5 by broadcasting by itself, no matter how much power it uses. Okay. So perhaps in its broadcast path, there is a big mountain in between. So if it just broadcasts from here, no matter how much power is used, you don't actually reach vertex 5. Okay. To broadcast to vertex 5, or to send a message to vertex 5, vertex 1 would have to broadcast, say, using 4 units of power getting to vertex 2 and vertex 4, and then vertex 2 could maybe broadcast using 8 units of power and it would reach vertex 5. Okay. So, in the context of communicating or broadcasting in wireless networks, we're interested in finding a spanning tree with a given source. So it's a rooted spanning tree, I'm told where we have to begin. And then we will initiate a sequence of broadcasts where this fellow first broadcasts using some amount of power. I guess if we were to use this blue spanning tree, we would have to broadcast using 4 units of power. That would get us to both vertex 2 and 4. Then vertex 2 would broadcast using 8 units of power. Vertex 4 would relay the signal using 5 units of power and reach here. Vertex 5 would relay the signal using 6 units of power. That would get us to both 3 and to 9. Okay. And vertex 9 would broadcast using 8 units of power. That would get you to 11 as well as to 8. Vertex 11 could broadcast using 3 units of power. That would get you to 10. So if you add up all the power needed by the nodes for the individual broadcast so that you can get to every node, it'll work out to be 41 units. Okay. So really at each node, you look at the power needed to get to each of the children, you take the max of that, that becomes the broadcast power for that particular node, then you add up across all nodes. Node 10 doesn't broadcast to anybody, so uses zero power and so on. Okay. So when all your nodes are operating off of batteries, one of the things you'd like to do is conserve the energy, okay? And so you'd be interested in finding a spanning tree that uses the smallest total amount of power to get the job done, okay? Okay. Now, unfortunately, finding minimum power or minimum energy spanning trees is an NP-hard problem. We aren't going to study that problem any further in this class. The previous version, where the spanning tree cost is the sum of the edge costs, is a much simpler problem to solve. And we will look at fast algorithms to find minimum cost spanning trees, but not minimum power spanning trees. Okay. All right. All right, that concludes the first part of today's lecture, where we were just going to look at some problems of interest with respect to graphs. As I said earlier, people have formulated literally thousands of problems and graphs that they'd like to solve, and certainly with the 6 to 10 that we might look at in this class, we won't be looking at even a very small fraction of that, of the total number of problems people want to solve on graphs. All right, in the remainder of today's lecture, I want to take a look at how we might represent a graph in memory. Okay. Basically, graph representation methods could be broken down into two categories. One, we employ a matrix called the adjacency matrix, and the other one, we employ lists called adjacency lists. And within adjacency lists, individual lists could be linked lists, or they could be array lists. Okay. Now, these are the types we're going to look at in class here. Of course, there are other ways people like to represent graphs. I guess after adjacency representations, next would be incidence-type representations. So there you would have another three possibilities. You could have incidence matrix, incident lists, and within an incidence list, you could have linked incidence lists and array incidence lists, so giving you really a total of six different representations. Okay, well, we aren't going to look at the incidence type representations here. Start with an adjacency matrix. Okay. All right, an adjacency matrix is a 0-1 matrix. Number of rows and columns equals n, n being the number of vertices in the graph. Okay. An entry of the matrix, the ijth entry, is 1 if and only if you have the edge ij in the graph you're trying to represent. Okay. Otherwise, of course, it's a 0. Okay. Let's take a look at a graph. I have a 5-vertex graph here. This one happens to be undirected. Its adjacency matrix would be a 5-by-5 matrix. Okay. The ijth entry would be 1 if and only if there's an edge ij. Okay. So if I look at row 1, the 1-1 entry is 0 because you don't have an edge 1-1. In fact, no graph is allowed to have a self-edge, and therefore all the entries on the diagonals are necessarily 0. The 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4 are all 0. You can't have a corresponding edge. Okay. 1, 2, yep, there's an edge 1, 2, so that's a 1. 1, 3, there is no edge between 1 and 3. 1 and 4, you have an edge. 1 and 5, you don't. Looking at row 2, 2 and 1, there is an edge. 2 and 2, there's no edge. 2 and 3, nope, there's no edge. 2 and 4, there's no edge. And then 2 and 5, okay, you have an edge. Okay. All right, so let's fill in the rest. You should be able to see these as they pop up, why each one is a 0 or a 1. Right, 3, 5 is a 1, you have an edge. 4, 1, there is an edge. 4, 2, there is no edge. 4, 3, there's no edge. 4, 4, 4, 5. If you look at vertex 5, okay, or row 5, there's an edge to 2, 3, and 4. So 5, 2, 3, and 4 would be 1s, and the rest would be 0s. Okay. All right, so that's an adjacency matrix. Let's look at some properties of an adjacency matrix. As mentioned earlier, the diagonal is always 0 because you don't have self-edges. Okay. The other interesting property is that an adjacency matrix is symmetric, which means that if you were to fold this thing across this yellow line, the diagonal, then 1s will fall on top of 1s and 0s will fall on top of 0s. Okay. Another way to say the same thing is that the ijth entry of the matrix equals the jith entry of the matrix. If you look at a directed graph, again, it's a 0-1 adjacency matrix. Okay. Here, there's an edge from 2 to 1, so the 2-1 entry is a 1, but there's no edge from 1 to 2, so the 1-2 entry is a 0. All right, you can take a quick look at all the 0s and 1s and figure out why each is a 0 or a 1. Okay. Now, in the case of a digraph, okay, each edge will give you exactly 1-1 entry in the matrix. Okay. So here I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 edges, and there are 5 places where there are 1s. For an undirected graph, if you had 5 edges, there would be 10 places where you have 1s, because the edge connecting vertices 1 and 2 would show up as a 1 at position 1, 2, as well as 2, 1. Okay. So here, the number of 1s equals the number of edges for a digraph. The number of 1s equals 2 times the number of edges in an undirected graph. Now here, too, the diagonal entries are 0. And in this case, the matrix is not symmetric, okay? Or at least it need not be. It could be if for every edge ij you have an edge ji, but that's not required in a digraph, so the matrix isn't necessarily symmetric. If you analyze the space requirements for a matrix, you need n square bits of space. It's an n by n matrix. You can cut that down by roughly half, since if you have an undirected graph, because the matrix is symmetric, so you need to store only the lower or the upper triangle. So you can use one of the schemes we talked about early on in the class when we were representing special structured sparse matrices. If you have an adjacency matrix and you want to find the degree of a vertex, well, you have to march down the row counting the number of ones. That'll take you n units of time. You want to find all of the vertices adjacent to vertex 3, you'll have to march down vertex 3, row 3 of your matrix, looking for the ones, and that'll give you which vertices are adjacent. So that's also n units of time. Okay. All right, so that's just a couple of simple operations. Right, turn our attention now to adjacency lists. Okay. An adjacency list is a linear list. It contains all the vertices adjacent to a particular vertex. Okay. And we're going to have one adjacency list for each vertex in the graph. So if you have n of them, we'll collect these n adjacency lists into a one-dimensional array. Okay. So here we have our five-vertex undirected graph. There will be five adjacency lists. Here's the list for vertex 1. Okay. This tells you that 2 and 4 are adjacent to vertex 1. There's no requirement that these vertices be listed in ascending order. It just so happens that here they are in ascending order. I could have just as well said the adjacency list was 4, 2. List for vertex 2, vertices 1 and 5 are adjacent to vertex 2. Vertex 3 has vertex 5 adjacent to it. List for vertex 4, and then the list for vertex 5. Okay. The adjacency lists are collected into an array. In this case, I'm calling it A list, and the entries used are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. If you have linked adjacency lists, then each of the adjacency lists as shown in the previous picture would be represented as a chain. So that's A list 1, has elements 2 and 4, adjacency list for vertex 2, for vertex 3, for vertex 4, and vertex 5. Okay. All right, so to make this representation work, we need n spots in the array. Of course, if you're implementing this using Java, you would have position 0 that's wasted, so really the array has n plus 1 spots. Alternatively, you could do a mapping where A list 1 is stored in position 0 of the array and A list 2 in position 1 and so on. Okay. All right. But let's say you need roughly n units, an array of length about n. The number of nodes that you need, okay. The number of entries is 2 times the number of edges. It's an undirected graph, so if you have 1, 2, 2 will show up on the list for 1, 1 will show up on the list for 2. The number of entries is 2 times the number of edges. Okay. If you had a directed graph, then the number of entries would only be equal to the number of edges. Okay. Array adjacency lists are pretty much similar. We replace the chains with array lists. All right, and the metrics are pretty much the same. Of course, the real space used is less because you don't have pointer space that we had in the chain representation. Okay. All right, let's turn our attention to weighted graphs. Okay. In a weighted graph, we could use a cost adjacency matrix instead of a 0-1 matrix. We could store the cost of the edge in a spot in the array. If we have adjacency lists, then each element of the list, instead of just being a vertex, could also include the weight. So you could have pairs, the vertex that's adjacent and the weight of the edge to that vertex. Okay, so let's take a look now at representing this in Java. Okay. If we try to implement a package to support all kinds of graph representations, okay, then we'll need one Java class for each representation. So let's count the number of representations that we have. Okay. We have an adjacency matrix and we have adjacency lists. So that gives us three representations on that count. But then we also have directed and undirected graphs. So we need different classes for directed graphs as we do for undirected. We also have weighted and unweighted. So with graph types, we get four different graph types. And for each graph type, there are three possible representations, giving us 12 different Java classes that need to be implemented. If we threw in the incidence-based representations, then these 12 classes would become 24 classes. Okay. Now, many of the things we want to do with graphs can be coded in a representation-independent fashion. Okay. It doesn't depend on whether you had a weighted graph or an unweighted graph, you had an adjacency matrix or an incidence matrix or an adjacency list or an array adjacency list or a linked adjacency list. Okay. So rather than code all of these, rather than code this particular, the solution to a problem, say 24 times, one for each of the classes it's supposed to work on, we can code it once in an implementation independent fashion and keep that code in an abstract class, which could then be invoked by any actual implementation. So in the case of graphs, the abstract data type for a graph is not represented using an interface as we did for all of our other data structures. Rather, it's going to be given in the form of an abstract class. Okay. And okay. So if you were to look in the book, you'll see a abstract class there called graph, and the abstract class will contain the abstract data type methods. These are the ones that don't have an implementation and which will then be implemented in the classes that actually deal with the particular representation, adjacency matrix or cost matrix or what have you. We'll have an iterator for a graph, also an abstract method, and then we'll have all of the implementation independent methods down here. And these implementation independent methods will make use of the abstract methods which are actually defined in the individual classes in order to move around the graph and solve the particular problem. Okay. So for example, if you take a look at the abstract methods of the class graph, there we have things like vertices that tells us how many vertices a graph has, a method called edges. This will tell us how many edges the graph has. Another one called exists edge tells you whether or not the graph has an edge between I and J or from I to J. Something to put an edge in the graph. Something to remove an edge. Something that tells you the degree of a vertex, the in degree of a vertex, the out degree of a vertex, and so on. Okay. All right, so unlike the other data structures we've seen, for the case of a graph, we will specify it using an abstract Java class rather than as an interface. The reason we are doing this is because in the case of a graph, I'm going to find a need to provide an implementation for a large number of methods like path finding methods or spanning tree methods or connectedness methods. And these methods will make use of iterators and other abstract methods so that they can perform their task in an implementation-independent fashion. As a result, I will not need one implementation for every different representation that I come up with. Okay. And that's of great value in the context of a graph because, as we've seen, even if you limit yourself to adjacency representations, you have a potential of 12 different representations to deal with, which means you'll have to write the code 12 times. If you include the incidence representations, well, now suddenly you got 24 different representations to deal with. And you'll be writing essentially the same code, just tuning it a bit for the implementation that you have, whether it's a matrix or a linked list or an array list. And you'll be doing it 24 different times. To avoid that, one takes these methods that could be implemented in a manner that is independent of whether you have a matrix or a linked list or what, and you put them into an abstract class, and then the method is inherited by all of the implementation-specific classes, which would then extend this abstract class. Okay. Right, you can see this more clearly, I guess, if you actually go and look at the code, and it'll probably become a little clearer when we start looking at actual graph problems where we are doing this, one implementation works for all representations. Okay, so with that, I guess we will stop here today. Thank you.